Hello and welcome to Pleading, Proving, and Protecting Trade Secrets in Litigation. I would like to introduce you to your first presenter for today. He is a partner with Seyfarth Shaw in the New York office, Mr. David Monachino. Mr. Monachino, you have the floor.
Before we begin, we have to read a disclaimer. This is Bob Neiman in San Francisco. Here goes. This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion on any specific fact or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation and will be required on the CLE attendance verification form that will be sent via email immediately after today's presentation. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. And now, live from New York, David Monachino.
Hi, welcome everybody to our webinar. My name is Dave Monachino. I'm in the New York office. You'll be hearing from three panelists today, Bob Neiman in San Francisco, who just spoke, and Mike Wexler in our Chicago office. We're all members of Seyfarth's Trade Secret, Computer Fraud, and Non-Compete section, and Michael is the head of that group. So hopefully we'll get to learn something today. What we'll cover, briefly, we're going to assume that you know somewhat about what trade secrets are, but we're going to try to explain, I think, current trends in the law and what it takes to plead a trade secret case. We're also in the second section that Bob's going to be handling, try to give you some helpful insights on what to do in the discovery phase so you can protect your trade secrets and control costs and things like that to make sure discovery goes smoothly. And also Mike in the final section will try to discuss protective orders and what kind of discoveries was necessary to prove your case and defend your case. So what is a trade secret? Generally, a trade secret is something that has value and something that you keep secret. And I'm not going to go into too much details, but it's not generally known outside of your company. And inside your company, you safeguard it with passwords, physical security, and things like that. Usually, you expend a substantial amount of money to try to develop the trade secret. And courts will look to the difficulty or ease in which the information could be duplicated or acquired. There's a lot of different variations, but that's generally the law across the country. And under the Uniform Trade Secret Act, there's 46 states that have adopted that. I think there's still four common law states, New York being one of those. Massachusetts, I think North Carolina and Texas are the other three states that still go under the common law. But essentially, again, a trade secret has to have value, and you have to keep it secret. And, it's something that you want to protect. Examples of trade secrets, there are numerous examples, and we've listed a few here. I think our firm has compiled a list that we've worked on over the years, and it's literally got hundreds of potential trade secrets that we show to our clients when we're doing audits and things like that to really flush out what trade secrets are and identify the trade secret specifically. And if anybody would want a copy of our, we have a compiled list, like I said, of several hundred potential trade secrets. We could provide that to you offline if you're interested in that. The gist of pleading a trade secret case, you really need to understand what a trade secret is. And these lists that we have here, the customer list, formulas, and things like that, that's how people used to plead trade secret cases. They would just write in their complaint, we have customer lists, we think they're valuable, and they're not out in the public. Or we have marketing strategy or pricing information. And, until recently that seemed to be okay with a lot of courts just to say, okay, you have a trade secret, we'll take you at your word. Not so much anymore. We go to the next slide. This is the federal 12b6 standard. In around 2007, in a case called Twombly, and it was followed up in 2009 with a case called Iqbal, the Supreme Court of the United States had started taking the position that in any case, not just trade secret case, that litigants should really set forth what they, some factual basis for, you know, what they believe their claim is. Because there, I you know, and this is just guessing, there's so many cases that were filed that were so bare bones that the court probably based on, you know, thousands and thousands of cases that were filed that maybe were frivolous, you know, finally sat down and said, look, we need to have some kind of facial plausibility to your complaint. And just because you say you have something, or in any kind of case, if you're not willing to, you know, put some facts with the elements of the cause action, we're not going to keep that case around. So, you know, essentially you have to put facts in a complaint. So taking that, what's required to be pled in a trade secret case? So I've knocked off three different cases that we're going to talk about briefly, and they really demonstrate the different ends of where courts have come out on pleading trade secret cases. I think it's very topical. I'm actually researching an article right now, and it seems to me that in the recent months, there's been a lot more motions dismissed on trade secret cases than I've seen in the last probably 20 years. You know, there's only a couple dozen cases on the subject, but it seems that the trend is really starting to pick up. And in fact, there was just a case in New York 2 days ago on this subject that we'll talk about in a little bit. But on one extreme is this case called Reckitt Benckiser versus Tris Pharma. It was last summer in the Federal District Court of New Jersey. And I'd just like to mention that New Jersey just recently adopted a Trade Secret Act this year. So this case may not still be good law, but it is an example of a court not granting a motion to dismiss. This was an interesting case because it included both patents and trade secrets, which is a little counterintuitive because trade secrets you're supposed to try to keep secret, and patents, really the object of the Patent Act is to disclose as much as you possibly can about the patent with prior art and things like that. And also, you know, if you look at a patent application, you're supposed to be able to recreate the patent. So it's a little bit counterintuitive to have a trade secret and a patent case in the same case, but it does happen, and this was one of those cases. This was in front of a Judge Wolfson out of the district court in Newark, and the case essentially is a very typical scenario. Former employee was a Dr. Toll that worked for the plaintiff for 10 years. They had developed some over-the-counter cough syrup. They had gotten a patent on it. Dr. Toll goes to the competitor, and lo and behold, Rickett decides to sue Dr. Toll because they believe that he took some of his patents and their patents and trade secrets. So, you know, the complaint comes in. It's pretty bare bones, and the defendants basically say, we're going to dismiss this because you don't have enough information for us to even defend this case. You know, specifically, I read the pleadings on this. The defendant said, you know, plaintiff, you're uniquely qualified to elaborate what you think is your trade secrets. That was their first claim. So you should do that because we have no idea what you're talking about. And two, the second aspect was, you know, you have all these patents, and it's counterintuitive to say that you have trade secrets that go along with these patents, and you should have some kind of heightened pleading requirement saying how your trade secrets differ than your patents, which is conceptually makes sense, I think. But this judge in Newark, Judge Wolfson, said, no, under New Jersey law, we don't think you have to plead specifically. And they went into Iqbal and they went through Twombly and said, no, you know, even though it's pretty bare bones that they just said they're generally known and there's value, it's possible that trade secrets were developed after the patent applications, and you have to kind of take them at their word. I don't know if it's such a well-reasoned decision, but it's not atypical, and I think that used to be the trend. And now, like I said, New Jersey has passed a Trade Secret Act, so I don't know if the judge would come out the same way. So the next case to look at is Clean Earth Holding. This was a Supreme Court case, which is our trial court level in New York, and we have a commercial part with eight judges that are considered better judges in New York, I think, or not better, but maybe more qualified, more experienced. So it's kind of a step up from the normal Supreme Court judge. And Clean Earth Holding came before a Judge Ramos, who, if we have some practitioners out there, is a very good judge, but not very favorable to trade secret cases. And, you know, he's pretty hardcore, and he runs a tight ship, and he wants specific pleading. This case actually was not a motion to dismiss, but summary judgment. But I think it's a good example of what you need to plead, and what the trend in New York, at least, I think, is going towards this case. And I certainly think if you came to Justice Ramos's courtroom and try to argue a motion to dismiss using this kind of precedent, I think you could do well and maybe get a case dismissed. But this case was, again, a bunch of former employees worked at a soil reclamation, cleaning, kind of transport-type garbage disposal business, and the plaintiff in this case said, you know, we had these strategies for cornering the market, we have this great client base, we have all these customer lists, and these former employees are basically just stealing our business and duplicating it. So there was some discovery in this, and Judge Ramos went through the elements of what a trade secret is, some of the ones I mentioned before, you know, how widely it's known, how much money you put into this. And at the end, Justice Ramos's decision seemed to read like a motion to dismiss and didn't really get into the facts. And there was a client certification submitted in opposition to the summary judgment motion. The client certification basically said, we have these customer lists. They're really valuable. We spent a lot of money on them. You know, the typical pleading, just regurgitating the complaint. And Justice Ramos says, no, you need to be very specific. And, you know, he doesn't lay out what very specific is, but you can kind of do the math. He wanted to know, you know, there is passwords. We have a certain system of, you know, called XYZ. We have security guards at the desk. We give email messages that says, you know, this is confidential. It's not just a customer list. We have buying habits. We have our main client's daughter's and birthday's name. There, you know, specifics with the customer list, not just stuff you can get out of the phone book. So, you know, a well-pleaded complaint will go into the actual details. You know, not that we spent a lot of money. We spent $2,658 on our waste management cleaning system. That kind of information would go well with the Justice Ramos, and I think that this would have gotten to trial if they would have done that. So this is an unpublished decision, but I think it's kind of the trend in New York that you need to publish. And if anybody, again, needs a copy of any of these decisions that I'm talking to, please feel free to contact us after the seminar. Then the last case is on the other end. It's called Thale versus Fox Corporation. And again, it's another very strong-minded judge that some of the people listening to this might know, or Judge Shindlund. She became famous in the early 2003 era with a series of cases called Zubelake versus UBS. She basically started all the e-discovery obligations, at least in the Southern District, and I think the 2006 rules, federal rules, picked up a lot of her suggestions on the obligations the lawyers have to each other in discovery. So this case, Thale, comes before Judge Shindlund. There was a pro se plaintiff, but clearly the pro se plaintiff had gotten a copy of some pretty good pleadings from somewhere, because I read the complaint, and it's pretty detailed. Looks like a lawyer wrote it, but, you know, it's more of a cut-and-paste job than a great job. But this pro se plaintiff essentially said he invented two things called Music Flow and Shy Dancer. Music Flow was essentially a multi-city tour of musicians that went around to a bunch of cities where they performed, and Shy Dancer was a concept for a television show where it would air selected tapes of participants dancing in their households, you know, I guess free of inhibition. Plaintiff Thale basically sued Simon Cowell, EMI Music, Sony, Simon Fuller, and said, you stole my idea and you created American Idol, Dancing with the Stars, I think America's Got Talent, and all these other shows. You know, it sounds like Thale might have been, you know, your typical pro se that was delusional, but he didn't have a marketing plan. And he did, I guess, forward the marketing plan to some aspect of EMI Music, and EMI Music must have looked at it because they sent it back to him a couple weeks later saying, we're not interested. I guess Thale also said he invented the catchphrase, I'm going to Hollywood, or I'm not going to Hollywood. And so he sued. it seems like he sued and he created this plan in 1997, so I'm not sure there's a statute of limitations issue here, but it wasn't brought up. But he sued all these, you know, big companies for fraud, copyright infringement, theft of trade secrets, unfair competition, you know, breach of fiduciary duty, RICO, you know, whatever you could think of. Like I said, he got a hold of some complaint somewhere. Judge Shindlin, interestingly enough, I think it's the first time I saw New York on a motion to dismiss, granted the motion to dismiss with prejudice, which is a little counterintuitive because she said there's no set of facts that Thale could plead that would make this a viable trade secret case. And, you know, generally, pro ses are given a little bit of leeway. So either Thale did something to piss Judge Shindlin off or she just wanted to get rid of this case. But she basically said the marketing plan wasn't treated as a trade secret. And when Sony or EMI got a copy of the plan, he didn't treat it as a trade secret either. So, I mean, I could probably envision a set of facts that a pro se could have repled this case. But I think Justice Shindlin, you know, had probably seen enough of this pro se person and enough of these type of complaints, and she went through Iqbal and said, no, you have an obligation to put more facts to these allegations, and I don't want this type of case in federal court. So that's the other extreme, you know, on the other end. But I think while this is a little bit of an extreme case, I think this is going to be the trend in New York and probably across the country, that courts are going to look at complaints a lot more seriously. So if we can go to the next slide. Let's see. Why does it matter? I think I probably have a minute or two. You know, the main thing is, and I want to talk about one other quick case, and kind of it'll be a segue into Bob, that I think it's important that people realize what trade secrets are. I know we get a lot of calls, you know, someone leaves the company and the client's all upset, and so, you know, you say, why are you upset? Well, he's got all these trade secrets, and then you ask him, what are these trade secrets? And people generally have an idea what's important, but they either haven't taken the steps to protect it, or they haven't really analyzed what it is these people had access to and why they're so valuable, because the business people in different areas don't kind of connect with each other and figure things out. So I think it's important for companies to work with their lawyers to develop what they think are trade secrets, develop a good plan to protect the trade secrets. So then when you write a complaint, you really know what you're talking about, and you don't stand the risk of, you know, getting kicked out of the box right away, or at least when discovery, and Bob's going to talk about discovery in a few seconds, you know, you kind of know what you're talking about, and you can be, you know, nimble. You can go get an injunction if you need to, and if you want to talk to the judge intelligently, you'll have a real heads up. And I'll just mention it very briefly, because I know I'm probably going over time. There was a case literally 2 days ago that just came to our attention called MSCI versus a company called Axiom. It's a software case, and it's the first time I've seen a very detailed, not the detail, but a good decision from a judge, Justice Kornreich, that said that at the very beginning of discovery, you can't just say you have a trade secret and claim that all your software is a trade secret. This judge made the litigants, the plaintiff, actually break down their software and say what was publicly available in the software, what's a common algorithm, and what's part of third-party licensing before she let them do any kind of discovery, which I think is really the trend in the law. So there's some questions, then we can try to answer them. Go ahead, Bob.
Thanks, David. So now we're going to move from the pleading stage to the discovery issues. And during the time that a trade secret case is pending, at some point the plaintiff is going to have to disclose to the other side, to the defense, what the trade secret is, or if there's more, what they are. And the defendant has a right to know that. But the issue in discovery in trade secret cases is the timing of it. When will this disclosure take place, and how will it be protected such that it can't be used later on by a possible waiver? So many of our cases, as David mentioned, do not involve espionage. A lot of them involve your own employees who leave and go to a competitor. And many of these competitors are very fiercely competitive, so that the trade secrets are very important. And if one employee leaves and goes to another company, you've got to be able to protect against that. We've talked a little bit about state and federal court, but also sometimes your employees leave and they have an arbitration clause, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that as well. So in terms of pleadings, David mentioned that the courts are getting more scrutinizing about being complete, or at least having some foundation for the trade secret. The problem is it's a public document in almost all cases. Even arbitrations are really public record document forms, but certainly state and federal courts. So if you're going to produce it in a pleading, you have to be very careful in how you do it to either not disclose it or protect it as it's being filed with the court system. Seeking a court order ex parte is often difficult and often denied. In California, it's very difficult to get a document sealed. Also, if you're seeking TRO protection, that usually requires significant detail and disclosure, either in some type of a declaration, or often you have to put some of your scientists or CEOs on the stand to identify the trade secret so that the TRO can be granted. And this is going to be very difficult because you want to have the trade secret protected, but you also want to protect it from public disclosure, and you might not even know who's going to represent the defendant yet if you're the plaintiff, so that you can't ask their opposing counsel for some type of a stipulation. Other times, if you have a lot of cases against a particular party, you might know who their counsel will be, and you can call them ahead of time and ask for them to appear in court or to give you a stipulation so that you can file your document under some type of a protective order. Also, here's a little practice tip. If you have an arbitration clause with your employee or former employee, make sure that you always have a separate carve-out to seek TROs or any kind of equitable protection, because you usually can't get protection in an arbitration for equitable remedies or a TRO. So make sure that you have a separate clause in your arbitration that allows you to go to court for a TRO if necessary. Next slide, please. So one way to avoid it during the initial pleading is to plead it generally without giving any specifics, but plead it specifically enough to get past the court. We still have demurs out here, but also a 12B motion in federal court. But keep it limited enough so that you can disclose at a later date. file the complaint publicly, but also get the document under seal. This can be done by an ex parte appearance, but also, as I mentioned before, you might be able to get the other side to stipulate. Or you could file a complaint without the document or without the information and then file an amended complaint later on with the secret attached to it once you get the other side to stipulate to it. And the importance of this, of course, is to balance the right of the plaintiffs to maintain their the secrecy of their product or of their information, but also the defendant has a right to know what they are accused of having taken. So next slide, please. In California, we have a very important statute, and this really controls the tempo and the information that is disclosed. And this is CCP 2019.210. It allows for disclosure without filing it as a public document. In California, our discovery documents, such as interrogatories and requests for admissions and document productions, are normally not filed with the court. By the way, other states have this similar statute under consideration. And it basically says that during a misappropriation for trade secrets case under the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, or in California, before any discovery can be commenced, the plaintiff has to disclose what the secret or secrets are with reasonable particularity. And we'll get to what that means in just a moment. And as is noted in the little B section there, it told the plaintiff's ability to conduct disclosure, and this means what it says. The plaintiffs will not be allowed to conduct any disclosure before they actually comply with 2019. And, of course, this is state court in California, and there's a difference in federal court, and we'll get to that in just a moment. So let's go to the next slide for the timing of the disclosure. Normally, the 2019 request will come from defense counsel right around the end of the pleading stage. This does not prevent plaintiffs from disclosing it early, but normally the defense counsel sends a letter or some type of request for a 2019 compliance. It could occur earlier. As mentioned, a TRO that requires expedited disclosure, where you want to take depositions within 10 days so that you can have your preliminary injunction hearing, you'll need to comply with 2019 before you can even begin on this course. So you need to talk to your clients in advance about the 2019 disclosure to make sure that you're ready to do it. There are many ways to do the 2019, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but generally speaking, it's a simple document that's sent to the other side that identifies your trade secret or secrets with reasonable particularity. And again, the defendants want to know what this is so they can determine if it was taken and if it's a secret, and ask the court to either say that it's not or that it was not taken. 2019 does allow for good faith disclosures to be broadened or to be narrowed, and the controlling case on this is the Vaco Industries case. It's an older case, as you can see, but it's a good case because the scope of the 2019 has been steadfast since it was put into place in our code sections. So it means what it says, and the disclosure has to be reasonable in scope and time, and there can't be any sandbagging, because that's what usually is the dispute between the defendant and the plaintiff. Plaintiff feels that they have complied with 2019, and the defendant feels that they have not. Motions to compel or motions to prohibit discovery from being conducted are common in this area. Defendants will refuse to respond to discovery because the 2019 is insufficient. There's a question about whether the defendant has to move for a protective order on the discovery or move to compel the 2019. When in doubt, do both. You know, object, file a motion for protective order on the discovery, and file a motion for a more definite statement on the 2019 disclosure. Next slide, please. So, reasonable particularity. If you've ever done any criminal work, you know that that's how they describe search warrants, that the area or the persons or the place to be searched has to be described with reasonable particularity. And it's defined pretty well in the advanced modular sputtering case. It's funny because the court noted in that decision that reasonable particularity is deliberately vague so as to allow for flexibility on a case-by-case analysis. So a reasonable particularity, you're not going to find any very scientific or definitive description of it. And David mentioned the New York case from last Friday, the MSCI versus Jacobs case. And that court also talked about the reasonable particularity standard and used those same words. So even though the courts don't have the same statute necessarily in separate states, they do look to this. Which brings us to our federal cases on this same slide. As expected, there's no specific adaptation in federal court of 2019. Some of the federal courts have said it is a substantive code section. Others say it is procedural. So some will adopt 2019 and enforce it, and other federal courts do not. You should check around with your other colleagues to see if they've had any experience with any particular judge and how they view 2019 and its use in a federal court. Those cases that have not adopted 2019 have nonetheless used it as a guideline, even if it's not an applicable statute that they will give any kind of credence to. They still use it for guidance. So on to our next slide, please. Methods of disclosure in 2019. 2019 protects both sides, because if the plaintiff says we have a formula that was taken, it protects them from having the defendants come back and say, well, let's see your customer list as well. It also protects the defendants because they know that they're accused of taking a formula and not a customer list. So the 2019 really narrows the issues and narrows the scope of the discovery that will take place. And so the defendants will be prohibited from going into discovery in non-relevant areas, and plaintiffs will be able to stand on objections that they have completely disclosed information under 2019. 2019 can be satisfied in a number of ways, as I mentioned before. You can use the simple disclosure if it's a fairly simple trade secret that you're alleging. You can also use stipulations. A deposition can be a form of disclosure for 2019. Declarations or discovery responses to further define or limit the trade secrets. You can also use documents to define the trade secret, particularly if it's a source code or blueprints or something that requires more than just a visual or an oral production of the information. It might have to be something that is contained even on some type of computer or chip. that could be used to describe the secret. A practice note again on withdrawing a trade secret from contention. If you disclose, let's say, five secrets, and later on under 2019 you are allowed to reduce that and you say, well, now I'm down to four or three, those other two I've decided were not secrets, you better be careful, because without some type of a protective order, you may have waived the secrecy of that secret that you are withdrawing unless you get it protected with some type of a stipulation. So if you put it on that 2019 and you want to withdraw it, be careful that you get a protective order or some type of stipulation that can be withdrawn and that it will remain protected. There's penalties under 2019 for failing to designate a trade secret and timely disclose it, and that is that it will be inadmissible at trial. So if you don't amend in a proper fashion to give time for the other side to get ready and to determine the nature and extent of the taking of the trade secret, or if it in fact is a trade secret, if you fail to designate under 2019, the court can do many types of sanctions to you, but the most that will happen, and it will happen, is that you will not be able to discuss that trade secret at trial as having been misappropriated. And finally, before we go on to Michael's section, depositions need to be safeguarded with advance protective orders. I know many of you have used protective orders such as attorney's eyes only, or during a deposition when the trade secret itself is to be discussed, you instruct the court reporter to limit the scope of the production of these next 10 pages of the deposition, or however long you need to protect it. And of course, you should have protective orders in place anyway for all depositions, but an additional safeguard would be to have an attorney's eyes only section of a deposition when you get to that point. So that's the summary of how you disclose and protect your trade secrets during the discovery process. And now on to my partner, Mike Waxler, who will talk about some further protective orders and other methods of protecting trade secrets in litigation. Mike?
Bob, I think right now would be a good time to read the CLE code to all of the folks listening.
Thank you for that. There I go. To receive CLE credit for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance verification form that will be sent via email immediately after today's presentation. Submit the form to the person indicated on that page. Everyone ready with your pen? Here's the code. SS, as in Sifar Shaw, 8283. That's SS8283. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Bob. So now we're going to talk about some specifics with regard to conducting discovery in a trade secrets matter. And the first thing, which I think Bob alluded to time and time again, is you need to protect the trade secrets. And how do you do that? The common way to protect trade secrets is to use a protective order. And what we mean by that is an order that both sides agree to that is signed by the court, which instructs both parties, as well as what the court needs to do when it comes to actually designating information as being confidential and taking procedures to protect it, such as filing things under seal, putting things in sealed envelopes, putting designations on documents as to whether it's confidential or some other level of security. And so what you do, as a practical matter, is upon filing a trade secrets lawsuit, when you first have your interaction with the other side, that's the time, and usually the plaintiff is the one who will propose the protective order, since the plaintiff is usually the one who has accused someone of taking secrets and is the one who owns the secrets. They will usually propose to the other side, the defendants, a protective order that would allow for protection of the trade secrets, so that when you do things like the trade secret designation statement that Bob was speaking to, you actually have a document in place that the court has approved, which will allow for protection of that document, as well as documents that may be produced that actually show the trade secrets as well in discovery. So your first step is to prepare a protective order. And the protective order needs to be tailored to the specific allegations and the information that's involved in the lawsuit that you're in. You may have a lawsuit that involves particular formulas or software or pricing, and the form of those types of information differ greatly. And because they differ greatly, you need to take into account how those pieces of information exist in the normal course of business, as well as how those documents, formulas, processes, price lists, those sorts of things may be produced in litigation. Maybe things can only be inspected. Maybe you have a trade secret in how you manufacture a particular product, and the secret can be described in a designation statement, but there's also going to have to be an inspection of the actual facility where production takes place potentially. And because of that, you need to think about those things so that if you need to have a physical inspection, if you need to produce a disk with software on it, if you need to produce physical hard copy documents, you account for those things when you think about your lawsuit. There are some courts that actually have standard protective orders. And on the slide here, you can see a website that you can go to, which is the California Northern District, where they have a standard protective order, which is a good resource to look at. It's not the be-all, end-all, but it's certainly a good resource to look at, which may guide you in coming up with your own protective order that's relevant to your case. Now, let's talk about the basics of a protective order and what needs to be in it. First of all, you start out your protective order with specifying the information to be covered. And by that, we mean list the information that's going to be covered. For example, you may identify things such as price lists or processes or formulas. You may identify specific types of software and information, and you describe what the information is broadly that needs to be protected by this protective order. The next thing you do is you describe where it can be found. Is it found in is it going to be information in documents? Is it going to be information in depositions? Is it going to be information in inspections that will occur during the case? You need to think about those things, and you want to describe where the information may be found. Is it going to be produced by each side? Of course it is. Is it going to come up at a hearing? Is it going to come up at trial? Of course. And you want to describe where the information is going to be found. The next thing you want to do in your protective order is to specify the manner of identifying it. And by that we mean providing a legend on the information. For example, the simplest thing to do is to specify, for example, documents need to be labeled confidential or confidential attorney's eyes only, or confidential experts only. There's variations of that, but a legend on the physical document. Maybe you produce a disk, and the disk may have on it thousands of documents, which you may be able to, through a service, automatically number and automatically designate those documents as to what level of confidentiality. But you may also want to specify in your protective order that you need to label that disk, physically label it, in order to incorporate the designation onto that disk. You would also describe a thing such as depositions and how those might be labeled. And you might describe it needs to be labeled on the front page of the transcript, or information that is of a particular confidentiality level needs to be put in a separate envelope apart from the main transcript. So you want to specify those things as to how each party will designate information that needs to be kept confidential, confidential attorney's eyes only, and those sorts of designation, and how it's to be treated. You also want to specify the manner that a third party might use to designate information. For example, you may serve a third-party subpoena on someone. They may be then required to produce information that they consider to be confidential, and you need to account for allowing a third party to designate information. The next thing you need to do is to describe the designation categories, meaning what type of categories of confidentiality do you need? How far do you have to go? Is it a one-tiered approach, meaning everything may be designated confidential, and if it is designated confidential, then who can see it? And as far as who can see it, confidential, if it's just confidential, you might say that that level will allow the parties and counsel and the court to see things, but no one in the public can see them. You might add a second layer of confidential attorney's eyes only, which might mean that only outside counsel could see a particular pieces of information, as well as the court and experts. And you might have a third category, which may allow for attorney's eyes only, but maybe there's one in-house counsel designated to review certain information. Or maybe you have a category called confidential experts only, so only experts can see information and the court. So you need to think about the types of people who may view information and provide for those different designation categories. So when you're operating, actually using the protective order, you will then know how to label things. Next, you need to describe how the information can be used, meaning can it be used in court, can it be used in a deposition, can it be used in a pleading, can it be used at trial, can it be used at some other sort of hearing. And with that, of course, you need to describe who can see those documents, as we've just talked about. The next thing you need to do is you need to describe in the protective order the process for objecting to designations and correcting mistakes. And by that I mean if I, as a plaintiff, designate something as confidential attorney's eyes only, and the defendant decides that designation is too high and they want to be able to show a particular document to their client, they then need to designate, they will ask whether or not, and through this procedure described in protective order, they will ask, will you redesignate that confidential only so I can show it to my client? And if we agree, great. If we don't agree, then there's a process by which in the protective order it states that if there's a disagreement, then I need to go file a motion with the court as a plaintiff purporting to want the information protected to a higher level, or you folks may decide in your agreement that you want the party objecting to go file a motion and have the burden of bringing to the court whether something should be a lower designation. And depending on the case, depending on the parties, depending on your judge, you will come up with the proper method for objecting to a designation. And then also for correcting mistakes. What happens if you don't designate something, you need to do it later? What happens if you over-designate something? How do you deal with that? Is it simply sending a letter? Is it reproducing the same information with a different designation on it? Is it something where you describe that the document needs to be shredded and a new document needs to be provided, but you decide amongst yourself what the proper way is to correct the mistake? And then finally, you have the duty. What is the duty under the protective order? It's a duty to prohibit disclosure. Things need to be kept in a safe area. Things need to be only used for this case and cannot be used for competitive purpose. You need to describe what the actual requirement is under the protective order. What is the duty that arises by the designation? Next, you want to talk about filing under seal. How do you file documents designated a particular way with the court? And part of that depends on the court, and part of that depends on what you agree to. Some courts don't care what you agree to, and they have their own process. Other courts require a hearing, especially in California. California has a very strict procedure with regard to filing things under seal, and the judge needs to actually decide that something is worthy of being filed under seal. So you need to make those decisions. What happens if something's subpoenaed, and how do you designate that? And again, you describe that in your document. Well, if you need to make modifications, how do you make modifications? The parties can agree amongst themselves, or you need to go to court. What happens when the case is over? Final disposition. Does everything get shredded? Does it get returned to the producing party? Do you need to file a certification? And finally, the last part of a protective order is undertaking exhibit, which is an exhibit that is for anyone, and usually it's experts, but it could be someone else, that they need to sign in which they agree to be bound by the protective order. So you hire an expert, they're going to review things, you have them sign the exhibit, which basically says, I, John Smith, agree to be bound by this order, I agree to the jurisdiction of the court to enforce this order, and you know, I will keep things confidential. Once you've done that with your protective order, in your undertaking, you want to make sure that the undertaking provides for your experts and others. You want to make sure that the undertaking provides for a copy of the protective order to be given to the expert or to whoever else is reviewing the documents, and that they acknowledge they've received it, they acknowledge that they've read it, and they agree to be bound and submit to the jurisdiction of the court. And so you want to have those four basic elements in the undertaking so that the protective order will apply to people. It may be to a witness, it may be to an expert, it may be to a litigation consultant or jury consultant, but anyone who falls within the appropriate categories to review confidential information will need to sign the undertaking exhibit. What do you need to think about when you're devising your protective order? You want to think about who needs to have access to the information as a practical matter so you can litigate your case. You need to decide who shouldn't see the information. Are you going to produce things that you don't want the other side's company representatives to see because it is so highly confidential and could give a competitive advantage to the other side in addition to the information that you as a plaintiff might be claiming was stolen already? You need to decide on how many people can see it. I call it a numerical limitation on access to materials. Just how many people do you want seeing it? You may say only 10 people can see it, only 5 people can see it. Or you may decide that certain categories of people can see things. For example, as we said, only experts, or maybe one in-house counsel, maybe one business representative. Now, again, you as a plaintiff who most likely will design this need to think about those considerations. And then if you are a defendant, you need to think about also these same considerations on the other side of it, and what do you need in order to successfully defend your case And does the protective order provide for appropriate protections for your information? Because many times a plaintiff will ask for certain information from a defendant that a defendant considers to be their own confidential information, because a plaintiff might be alleging that the defendant has incorporated plaintiff's information into defendant's information. So both sides need to equally think about these things, reach an agreement, and if they can't reach an agreement, then go to the court, present a protective order to the court, and you may have to battle it out in front of the judge, or the judge may have their own protective order they like to use, or the judge may lock you in the jury room and say, you better figure it out, you have 1 hour. Finally, your protective order, you want to think about, what do you need to do at a hearing, what do you need to do at trial, what do you need to do at deposition, do you need to close a courtroom, do you need to file things under seal with the court, do you just provide them to the court redacted for a public version, and then go and provide a full version in camera, which I find is one of the easiest ways, and many judges will do this. You file a public version, which redacts out the confidential information, and that's what goes in the file, and then you provide to the court an in-camera version, which has the full information in it, so the court can read, review materials properly and make their decision, but you then don't have to worry about necessarily having a proceeding in front of the court to seal the document, because what you filed doesn't need sealing. You need to be concerned about discovery and what happens during discovery, and whether or not through discovery you may inadvertently disclose confidential information. So you need to always think about designating information under your protective order. You need to always think about who might be present at a deposition, and whether or not there's a person there that needs to sign the undertaking, or whether or not there's a person there that's outside of the categories that you specify in your protective order. For example, you ask questions that requires confidential attorney's eyes only designation, which is only for outside counsel, and there's a company representative there along with the deponent. You may have to ask the company representative to leave the room for certain aspects of questions and make sure on the record it's crystal clear that you've made your designation and that you've asked Jane or John Smith to leave the room during this part of the deposition. You certainly also need to be prepared to file motions in court if you need to file something under seal. You also need to be prepared if there's been an inadvertent, inadvertent disclosure to potentially deal with that in court. And so you need to always be aware of how your protective order is being used and what's going on in the discovery process to protect the information. The goals of plaintiffs and defendants are very different. From the plaintiff's perspective, it's to get proof of misappropriation, flush out defenses, and target how and what defendants and made with the information that the trade secret information that may be at issue in the case. From the defendant's perspective, you want to get specificity. You want to find a lack of protection. You want to find public disclosure, and you want to scrub out damages that the plaintiff is claiming they have suffered as a result of the trade secret disclosure. So we talk about discovery now, interrogatories. What do you need to do in your interrogatories? Well, in your interrogatories, basically, you want to ask questions that that ask a defendant, for example, or a plaintiff, whichever side you're on, to identify each trade secret you're asserting in the matter that's been misappropriated. So a defendant will ask that question to a plaintiff so that they can get, as Bob described earlier, the specificity that, as David also described, the specificity as to what the trade secrets are at issue and make the disclosure that's necessary. Because if you don't properly disclose trade secrets, you can, at summary judgment, lose because you didn't disclose with enough specificity your trade secret. A plaintiff needs to always be vigilant in describing the trade secret in detail, and a defendant has to be vigilant in forcing a plaintiff to describe it in enough detail. As a defendant, you may want to ask the plaintiff to identify economic value that's obtained from the trade secret not being generally known. Not just that secret, but how do you obtain value from the information not being generally known? And that's an area which a defendant will want to target in its interrogatories to a plaintiff. And then you want to identify the format on each media type that the trade secret has been kept. And that will help dictate what type of discovery you need to take, because obviously if something is on a computer, you're going to have different discovery issues than if something is kept in a binder, in a bookshelf somewhere. So you ask interrogatories like this so that you can figure out how to tailor your discovery. You also want to ask contention interrogatories. If you contend that, you would ask a plaintiff or a defendant, do you contend the trade secret is generally known to the public? And so a defendant will contend that as a defense. So as a plaintiff, you may give that question in interrogatory to the defendant to answer. And then you may follow up with, if you contend that particular trade secret is publicly available, then describe each such disclosure, where, when, who, and how it was disclosed, because, of course, you want to test that and actually figure out, was it really disclosed? If it was really disclosed, you want to be able to prove it as a defendant so that you have no liability, so you can prove there was no trade secret. And as from a plaintiff's perspective, you want to be able to show, no, it wasn't disclosed. And if the defendant does contend it was disclosed, you want to get the detail so that you can, of course, defend against that. E-discovery issues will arise. And in generality, because we could discuss e-discovery all day in a completely different webinar, generally, you want to be aware of the chain of custody of electronic items, such as a hard drive and a computer, and whose hands it was in, and how they get to a forensic examiner. You want to look at the dates and times of activity, because that can show you when information may have been taken or information was accessed, let's say, by an employee after they left. You want to know what a removable device history. So when forensics are being done, you want to know, were any thumb drives plugged into a particular computer? Were there file transfers? Is there cloud computing being used for storage, which will dictate whether information was kept in the cloud and was accessed? Is information kept on network, and how was it accessed if it was accessed? Other issues that arise now are through Skype, FTP sites, social media. Information can be disclosed in those as well. You want to look at personal email, of course, and text messages, and you want to look for data destruction, data wiping. Did someone use software to rub out information on a hard drive to hide the information from discovery and disclosure? Where is information kept? You need to think about this, of course, and this slide shows you a myriad of different places that information can be kept on the Internet, the cloud, mail servers, secondary servers, backup servers, hard drives, backup tapes, disks, on a PC, on a laptop, on a USB key, on an iPod, on a BlackBerry, a phone, your home PC. You got to think about those sorts of things as you're designing your discovery, where information was kept, where information was disclosed. Finally, you want a protocol for e-discovery. And again, we could discuss this all day, but in general terms, you need to have a protocol for e-discovery that talks about the scope of the discovery, who's going to perform any type of searching that might be done, the chain of custody that you need, imaging of computers, what will be searched, the search terms that will be used to search, hard drives, phones, iPods, iPads, those sorts of things, the report that the forensic person is going to give you back, you need to review for designations of privilege, so things are searched for, they're found, they then need to be reviewed and then turned over to the other side. What type of analysis is going to be done? Are they looking for evidence destruction software? Are they looking for deleted items? And then, again, a report is made. Finally, in discovery, you need to focus on damages. And pursuant to the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, generally compensatory damages or lost profits is the damage that usually plaintiffs look for in discovery. And so you'll ask questions in discovery to elicit information about the compensatory damages or lost profits that plaintiffs have suffered. If compensatory damages are not enough under the code, then unjust enrichment is also a way to look at damages, and how was a user of trade secrets, the improper user of trade secrets, benefited from that, or whether royalty should be paid for every use or disclosure or every type of product was produced using the trade secrets. Other considerations for damages include cost avoidance. Someone steals the information, and it's not just using information, you know, for the secret sauce, but if, for example, information was stolen about 10 secret sauces that didn't work and a competitor steals that, that saves them money. They don't have to try those combinations. So that's cost avoidance. Or if you get information about where not to go, that can give a competitor a head start. So if it took you 5 years to develop something and someone gets information where not to go, it may only take them a year and they save 4 years. And finally, you may want to value trade secrets. And what is the actual dollar value of a trade secret? So those are the general areas you should be looking for in discovery. Now, we have a few minutes left to answer a few questions. And there was one question earlier, and I think, Bob, if you want to answer this, the question is, in trade secret cases, what difference, if any, does it make whether the trade secrets are disclosed to a non-competitor as compared to a competitor, and does that matter for pleading purposes?
Yes. Well, remember, we're talking about intellectual property here that's not protected like a patent or a trademark or a copyright. So the value of the trade secret is the fact that it is a secret, and nothing else will provide that protection. So if you disclose something, let's again use the example of a departing employee. If that departing employee is going to go to a competitor, the fact that they have that information and are going to use it, you can get an injunction against them, but you know it might not protect it in the long run. The difficulty with fierce competitors is that they will try to use it in some other manner. And I've usually seen two types of people who depart. There's usually the person who takes the trade secret and intends to use it immediately, like a customer list. And then there's the other person who takes the trade secret, and they don't even tell their new employer, but they're going to use the information over a period of time. And they're going to look like the smartest person in the room, and the new employer is going to think, wow, this guy was great. This was a terrific hire because they know so much about this. And so I think one of the things you can do to protect against either one of those types of people are to ask the court for some type of administrative leave of that employee. Put them on ice until the time has passed that perhaps the secret either has dissolved or is not up to current status. Or, if necessary, ask that the person be put on leave for as long as a year until the state of the art can be changed. So that's how you have to treat someone who is a fierce competitor. A non-competitor, usually that's going to be a customer list. Someone is going to take it, let's say they're some type of an insurance person or entitled insurance, and they're going to take it to work at a new company like a construction company. And they want to be able to call on the same type of developers. So it's a customer list, but it's going to be used in a different format. But nonetheless, you don't want them using that list because you took a lot of time and effort and energy to prepare it. In those instances, getting the list back would probably be your best bet. So I hope I've answered that question.
We have another question. Do you typically allow experts to see AEO materials in your protective order, and what about in-house counsel? To the first part of the question, yes, we typically allow experts to see all attorney's eyes only materials. Because that's the highest designation. It's usually an expert that you might get for liability and damage reasons. They need to see everything, so that's pretty typical for an expert to see everything. In-house counsel, less so. It's the rare instance where in-house counsel, at least in my practice, where an in-house counsel will be able to view material in the protective order. There has to be a very specialized reason for it, and usually there's going to be a lot of debate about that. There's another question: under which grounds can defend object to the granting of a protective order? Not specific stipulations, but the order itself. That question is not exactly clear to me, but of course a defendant can object to a protective order, and usually it's to the specifics, and usually it's to the level of disclosure and what has to be disclosed that you'll see a defendant typically objecting to, and that it has to be worked out between the parties, or the judge will step in and will do what's normal, which is, you know, the typical protective order is two-tiered with confidential and then confidential attorney's eyes only. So I hope that answers that question. Let's see. How is information handled if someone's retained it in their memory when they go to a competitor? David, do you want to handle that?
Sure. It depends what state it is. Obviously, this is state specific, but there is a doctrine called inevitable disclosure. In New York, courts will say something like it's a slim read to rely on. If someone's going to do the exact same job for a competitor, a direct competitor, sometimes under New York law, if there's a non-compete agreement without any memorized information, with memorized information alone, a court may, if you're lucky, you could get an injunction. I had written an article once in Connecticut about what was called tribal learning, where a bunch of insurance people got together and they all took a part of the business in memory. And in that case, the court in Connecticut said, hey, you know what, you can't memorize all information and then start a competing business. Memorized information is the same as written information. So the cases are kind of split, but there's definitely a handful of cases that say if you memorized information and you go to a direct competitor, and you might inevitably disclose it, and that will be protected by the courts.
Well, thank you, David. It appears to be a little after 1 o'clock, and we thank everyone for attending. There were a number of questions that we just didn't have time to answer, and so on the screen, if you have an individual question or would like to contact Bob, David, or myself, please feel free. The email addresses as well as telephone numbers are on the screen. Copy those down if you wish. And we'd be glad to try to follow up and answer any questions you may have. Well, thank you, everyone, for attending, and please look forward to our next webinar which we will send an invitation out for within the next month or so. And thank you very much.